Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to this extra special episode shot at Porsche in the Park 2024. This episode is going to be particularly important to you if you've considered buying a 996 or 997 911. Now, there's only one place you would go, right, to build a 997 or 996 bulletproof engine, and that is Hartec. We're very lucky that actually at Porsche in the Park, Barry Hart, the owner, the founder, the guru of Hartec, joined me. So here you are for the next 40-ish minutes for the podcast, myself and Barry Hart at Porsche in the Park. Enjoy. Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to another episode today here at Porsche in the Park 2024. I've been excited about this since I was asked to be able to talk to this man. This man is Barry Hart from Hartec. Now, if you've ever thought about owning a 996 or 997 generation 911, you will know who this company is, even if you don't know the man behind the company, because you typically would then think, oh, I'm not going to buy one of those cars because I'm worried about a massive engine rebuild. Or you buy one with one of his team's rebuilt engines from the start. So that's what we're here to talk about today. But before we get into the full episode and the tech talk, welcome, Barry. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. Yeah, very well. Nice drive down from Bolton.
Yeah.
A bit frustrating on the M1 with the 50 limit.
Is it? It's 50 all the way, isn't it?
Nearly all the way down here, yeah. But anyway, lovely day, lovely setting. Didn't expect to see so many cars. Absolutely wonderful.
It's an amazing setting and an amazing amount of cars here. I did not know it was going to be this big or popular or, well, just well curated. So good job to everyone involved for that. Before we get into talking about the engine rebuild, the side of the business that you do all the time, you're an interesting man. You very kindly sent me some information over before we were having this. And I want to deep dive that before we get into the engine rebuild stuff. So let's start out with your professional education then. So engineering from a young man, was that the kind of always the thing that was in your head? Or
I think I was 10 years old when I had my first motorbike I bought from a Scout jumble sale and took the engine apart in my dad's shed.
And with knowledge to put it back together or just with that kind of...
No idea. And cleaned all the parts with a bit of petrol.
Yeah.
Washed it off in a bucket of water and wanted to see what it meant, combustion. It was only a little single cylinder engine, so I put it together with the head on but left it slightly unbolted and flicked the magneto over, and a blue flame came out both sides, set the back of the bench alight. And there I was, stood in 10 years old in my dad's shed, just about to burn it down. But I had a wonderful solution came immediately to mind. I got a bucket of water.
Good. That's
so
a good start.
I picked it up, sloshed it across the bench, and the whole shed went up. because of course, the petrol I'd been washing off in the bucket had all gone onto the surface and went all across the shed. But anyway.
Did you have a parent sprinting out, waving his arms frantically at you, screaming about how... Because, I mean, you're here, right? So you persevered from that moment onwards.
Fortunately, don't forget, we're talking a long time ago, and there were some black curtains behind in the corner, which were used for blackout in the war.
Wow, okay.
Due to black windows out. And
so they couldn't see you.
I had enough sense to pull them up, and I managed to get it out. Nobody found out.
Good.
But that was my first entrance into engines.
So you had a literal baptism of fire.
Absolutely.
Good.
And I realised what a combustion meant.
Fine. Okay. So that's as a 10-year-old. Did you do engineering at school?
I went to technical school at 13 and was given, you know, you've got the choice of doing things like physics and French and English literature. Or brickwork and plumbing and metalwork.
So if you want to build your own building and be a French engineer on French cars, you're probably sorted.
So I went for metalwork.
You went for metalwork?
Yeah, and woodwork. Made an electric guitar because I couldn't afford one. That sort of thing.
Yeah, brand.
But I always was interested in cars as well as motorbikes. But, you know, back in those days, no young lad could afford a car.
No.
So if you wanted transport, it had to be a motorcycle. And... I was very, very interested in racing. I thought that would be brilliant. So I did buy a bike that I could production race.
Wow, okay.
But my parents didn't know anything about it, because in those days you had to sign, if you're under 21,
yeah,
your parents or guardian signature on the entry
form. So you forged a signature to get into the racing?
No, I didn't know what to do. I didn't like the idea of forging it. So I thought...
So you took creative liberties and just sort of...
I thought, I wonder if they bothered to check everybody.
And they didn't?
No, I just left it empty. It only fell down when I rode back home on a rather beaten up Yamaha with a broken thumb, and they found out that in the bag I had on my back were the number plates.
Bloody hell.
So anyway, but that started an interest in bikes, and a fellow at university was racing a Norton, and he wanted a close ratio gearbox, couldn't afford it. And we came to the idea, look, we're supposed to be being trained to be engineers.
Yeah.
There's a machine shop here. You can't afford to pay for a close ratio gearbox. Why don't we try and make one?
Nice.
And we came up with the
Just on that, did you, in an engineering end-to-end design process, did you sit and work out the ratios you needed, what you were trying to achieve by building that? You did all the kind of pre-work. So it's not that you just turned up at a bench and started grinding away on stuff.
Oh, no. And funnily enough, we worked out that instead of replacing 8 gears to get 4 ratios, which... I think a firm called Quaife were doing it. We worked out that you only needed to change 2 gears and you could get almost the same ratios because it was a compound gearbox. And so this is why, although you guys aren't interested in motorbikes probably, this is the first time we realised that great big companies full of extremely capable and clever people often miss the obvious. And we kind of couldn't believe it would be possible that we could just make 2 gears and it would do the same job as someone else was making 8 gears for. But we were young and enthusiastic.
Young, excited and hungry.
We managed to talk a firm into making a few sets. They worked perfectly. And the Norton one started breaking, and the Works Nortons started racing and failing through broken gearboxes, and the people who had our gearboxes were breaking and they were carrying on.
And that same ethic, that still feels like it's there in Hartech today.
That's why I mention it, because it was the first time that we realised that it isn't that complicated engineering. The engines and gearboxes aren't that complicated. And I think people overcomplicate it to elevate their status, perhaps.
Yeah.
And very often they miss some very simple things. And I think what we do is pretty straightforward and it always works. Mm. Many other people could do it if they had the confidence to just follow their ideas.
Yeah.
But we do always align it with very high quality, the best we can possibly do.
And it's testament to that, because I don't see you guys doing a ton of social media. You know, you've just said off camera, you know, this is the first time you've ever done something and sat down and talked about yourself and the company. Firstly, thank you for doing that. But also, it's testament to that kind of those principles that you've held so close to you and what you've produced as afterwards. That's why the company's successful, because you're not doing huge amounts of publicity all over the place. But it's actually just staying true to your core values, making great products, doing great work, and then it's speaking for yourself.
But also it's to do with the staff, because it's not just down to one person. It's to do with our team. And, well, I've got Tobias here today. He's a cracking example.
Hello, Tobias.
Hello.
Tobias came to us when he was 15 and asked if he could do anything on a Saturday morning. And he seemed like a bright young lad, prepared to work. So we gave him some cars to clean. If I cut a long story short now, he's gone through university degree. He's in automotive engineering, and he's now a director of the company, running probably as general manager. And that's because we have a belief that almost anybody can do well if they're given the opportunity.
I agree.
And the right framework. You don't need to be a genius. These things are very straightforward. Mm. You just need opportunity and self-confidence. And that's what everybody who works for us, we believe in and try and create.
I'm a strong believer though that kind of the care and attention that you apply to the work, to the employees, that all of that is distills down into an amazing product, because you can have, you know, they're great technical engineering, but if you've got a terrible culture within the company and it's all kind of backstabbing and people are leaving left, right, and center, you get peaks and troughs of the inconsistencies, stuff goes out and it doesn't represent what you want it to represent, and then you get comebacks, and then the name of the company is through the floor in a really short amount of time. So, you know, credit to you guys for creating that culture within the company to do it in the first place.
Didn't come that easy though.
No. So
because when I made these motorbikes, if any of you have seen any of my history, you will find out that my little business grew from doing gearboxes to clutches to cylinders to cylinder heads and eventually to complete engines. And they went out and won internationals, gained podiums at Grand Prix, won the TT, won the fastest road race in Europe, which was the Northwest 200. And so what that proved to me was that somebody perfectly normal, average engineer like myself, given the freedom and opportunity to make what you have in your mind and try things, can actually achieve quite outstanding things. But I came across a technical innovation to do with high compression engines, and I didn't have the money to exploit it. And another very large public company came along and said, can I buy your company? We want to move you to Bolton in charge of motorcycle engine development as a director and rebuild the British motorbike industry. That sounded like a pretty attractive
proposition. For most people, that, not only the flattery of being asked.
Oh, the flattery was great, but the money wasn't too bad either.
I bet, yeah.
But when I got there, I found out exactly what you're alluding to.
Yeah.
And that they weren't the slightest bit interested in that technical innovation. They just wanted me to make some engines that would win races for the publicity and the promotion. And I had a 3-year contract, had to see it out.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I wasn't allowed to work on motorbikes for 3 years.
Wow.
If I left. So, but I what?
Did you suck it up and leave, or did you?
In my head, I wasn't going to leave. I was going to go. We'd be a great success.
Yeah.
Rebuild the British motorbike industry. That was until I sent out the drawings to various companies to make parts for us and got the quotes back. And when I did, I also sent the same drawings to Japan, and I also sent them to India, Germany, and Italy. And what happened was, the cheapest I could get the parts made in the UK was 5 times the cost of Italy, 8 times the cost of Japan.
Why?
And I asked the buyer, how much does it cost to buy all the raw material for us to make the engines? Like just metal, really. And to have that dropped off at our factory costs more than we could have all the parts delivered from Japan ready just to make an engine. So that, we're talking 50 years ago now, well, perhaps a bit more than that, 55 years ago. And I realised that British industry hadn't invested. We were still in the dark ages, and there was no way we could make engines unless most of it was made in third world or foreign countries.
Yeah.
But, you know, the company that I worked for, Armstrong, had factories in India. So I went to see the chairman and had a really good proposition, I thought. I said, look, India's going to be the next place that becomes a big motorcycle manufacturer. Massive population.
Mm-hmm.
They speak English. You've already got companies there. Let's set up the parts being made there and assemble them in the UK. I nearly got sacked. I've never had such a dressing down in my life as he gave me. Called me all the names in under the sun. So I knew that my ambition was crushed.
Yeah.
And so I spent a little while working for a composite company. I believe you've got experience in composites.
I have, yeah, that's right.
And found out that British metal engineers had no idea how to handle composites at the time, made stupid mistakes. Then an aerospace company came along and wanted me to join them as general manager, so I did that.
Mm.
But do you know, every time I went to work somewhere, the managers, the senior managers above our level, I couldn't understand them. They were stupid, to be honest.
Yeah.
But they were not doing things properly. They couldn't care less about the workforce. They weren't interested in investment. And I gradually realized that I was really happy when I had my little business making motorcycles.
Mm.
And I hadn't been happy while I was working for these companies.
Even that, even that level of happiness, that is shown in the quality of the products. 100%.
So I thought, what you may not know is I also had a love of Porsches. And I can't really explain it. I mean, just sat looking at these cars. What is it that Porsche have that just, I just love the look of them. Just, to me, there's nothing like it. They're absolutely fantastic. They're well engineered.
Yeah, I agree.
Which I obviously like. So when I was about 23, I actually wanted a Porsche, obviously couldn't afford one. But I found a 356C that had been imported from Belgium and couldn't get through the MOT, but it was left-hand drive.
What? So what year was this, roughly? Year?
Blimey. 56, 66, nearly 1970.
About, okay, about 1970, yeah.
And it was very cheap, so I bought it. The only problem was it was left-hand drive, and the petrol tank was on the right.
Yeah.
But the dashboard was nice and flat, so I made a hole in the petrol tank and welded a tube in it and put the steering shaft down through the tube to convert it to right-hand drive, painted it bright orange, and I had myself a lovely Porsche very cheaply with black lettering, shadow lettering down the side. For a young man, absolutely fantastic. And that then, I then wanted a 911.
Of course.
But I couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
But at the time, a lot of you might not realise they were actually appreciating, and it meant that if you could afford a new Porsche, if you kept it for 4 years, you could sell it for more than that at the end of the 4 years. So I went to see my bank manager for my little business, and
I mean, it's a great sales pitch for a bank manager, isn't it? Straight away,
persuaded him that if he lent me the money when I sold it, I could always give it to him back again, and he did. He lent me the money, so I ended up with quite a nice 911.
What was the spec of that? Tell me.
911T.
911T.
2 liter 911T.
Yeah. Colour?
Burgundy.
Burgundy.
Okay. Yeah.
Black interior.
Black. Yeah. Yeah.
Fuchs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
And later on, a Sportomatic.
Okay.
Four speed, 2.4, and that's where I learned to brake with my left foot. I remember thinking, driving along one day in it, I've got 2 feet. Two pedals, why am I only using one leg? So I put the...
I feel like this is going to be another explosive situation with a load of pedals.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I touched the brake with my left foot, and the next thing I remember was my nose being squashed on the windscreen. No feel whatsoever for it. And of course, as it slowed down, your foot pushed harder and harder.
Mm.
But I persevered. My business was in North Wales. I often drove on the A5 back towards Birmingham and London. And I found that if you had the guts not to take your foot off the throttle when you hit that corner, those old 911s were back end heavy. And if you took your brake, if you were going around a corner a bit too fast and you knew you were in trouble and you're probably going to go wide, if you lifted your foot off the brake, the back just came straight round and you crashed. And they had a reputation for it. But if you had the guts to keep your foot where it was...
And we already know you have the guts, so...
And could control the brake with your left foot, unbelievably, the cars would just come straight back online. Not even any fuss whatsoever. And it became a fantastic way to drive a 911 Porsche. And it's why I like the PDK I've got now. Because I always use my left foot now for braking. And I believe some of the Formula One drivers adopted it around that era as well. And so my love affair with Porsches continued. I've had them ever since I was a young man. I still do what I read in many of the forums when people take pictures of the back and the front and the side. I still go outside my house and look at them and just think that absolutely...
I don't think that ever changes. I think, I mean, I've met and spoke to lots of people now, and there's a common theme, and it's everybody will quite happily spend many hours just staring at their car. I mean, we all look completely mad, but...
We are completely mad. But how wonderful to be able to own one and have one. I mean, they're just marvellous. And when I wanted to eventually go back to working for myself, I remember having a discussion with the family, and my lovely wife said, "You're not happy working for this big company, are you?" I said, "No. You've got a massive salary, a supercar outside, but you're not happy, are you?" "No, I'm not." So she said, "Why don't you start up on your own?" And I said, "Yeah, but people with motorbikes have got no money. It's all Japanese now, you know, it's, I don't really know what to do." And she said, "Why don't you do, what do you love more than anything?" I said, "My Porsche." And she said, "Why don't you start a Porsche business? Looking after
and
Porsches."
And when was that roughly? What sort of year was this?
1984.
84, right. I was four.
But it took me 10 years before I started full time. But that's right, when I when I registered the company. So I put up with working for other people, put some money together, and eventually got my love of starting working on my own, accepting I'm never going to have a big business or be the director at the top of anything. And just, but I'm happy, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how it worked out. Never ever expected to use the engineering knowledge I had about. I mean, there aren't many people in the Porsche world who you could lock in a factory with machinery and could come out with a working engine and gearbox. And I could do that, you see.
Did you, a quick question on that, did you feel proud? Was there a sense of, you know, you had an awareness that you were very talented and proud of that?
No, because unfortunately, the British aren't very good at supporting people in some areas. And in the motorbike world, everybody just wanted Japanese products. And of course, when we were racing, we couldn't get sponsorship. Now, I was stupid. I thought British product, winning races, British motorbike, everyone will rush to help me. But I soon realized that if you supply tires or oil or spark plugs or whatever, clothing, whatever it is, your market is on Japanese bikes. They're not going to support you for just for the privilege of showing that the Brits can still win races.
So talk to me about that. So you started in 84. Called Hartek at that stage?
Yeah.
Called Hartek from the start, okay. And what was the...
called Hartek Porsche until Porsche got on with the legal side of things. So we soon got that changed.
just went to Hartek.
But with 924s and 944s to start with, and got quite a reputation for that.
For just supporting them generally? Or
servicing and sales.
Right, okay.
We found a very peculiar thing. Some of the cars were far better condition for the mileage than the others. There were like two categories. And we couldn't explain it for a while until we realized that half of them had been clocked. It was very common back then for people to wind the clock back, and there weren't proper records.
Yeah.
Until that is, somebody came in with a 944 that had done 105,000 miles and was in better condition than any of the ones that we'd seen in the first 2 years. And then another one turned up some time later. Tight, seats fine, steering wheel not worn out, you know, everything really good. It was only then that we realized that it wasn't that half of them were clocked and half of them weren't. It was half of them were clocked a lot, half of them were clocked a bit, and we'd only seen two cars that hadn't been clocked.
Amazing.
Now, that doesn't happen today very much.
No,
less so. Thank goodness. But we still come across cars that are, despite high mileage, are in fantastic condition.
Yeah.
I've got my own Gen 2 over there, which is on 110,000. And if I blanked off the steering wheel, the mileage, and you guys drove it, and I asked your opinion, you'd probably say 40,000.
And what's it done?
And that 110.
Nice.
And that's because it had two relatively small, lightweight owners who used it on the motorway.
Right. Just put miles on it.
Yeah. And so when you go and look for a car, I'm afraid using mileage is a very poor indication of how good the car might or might not be. And so when you're an expert, you can tell. So when cars come in to us for repair, we often find cars that we say, "Oh, look at that. It's a beautiful example. Wow, it's done all those miles." You know, and then there'll be another one that genuinely hasn't done many miles, and it'll be almost a wreck. And so it's very, very difficult for the general public.
Yeah.
To be able, yeah. even with a, even when people come around and you pay them to check it out, it's very hard to tell whether it's a good car or not. And our advice is always go and look at lots of cars. Because if you just go, if you just take the trouble, if you want a particular model, and you go and look at 10 or 12, you'll find an absolute beauty in that.
Yeah.
And the guy's selling it for the same price as the others because he doesn't realise it's an absolute beauty either. Yeah.
You know, by the way, I didn't do any of that. I literally bought the first, like probably most people, bought the first Porsche I saw. I was like, oh, I want that one. And then paid the money and that was it. So I'll learn that lesson from you.
So I never expected them to go wrong because the Porsche engineering was fantastic. However, as a guy who used to operate the machines that made the engine parts,
yeah,
I could recognize that they were very, very expensive to make.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to the Porsche factory and saw how they put the 911 air-cooled engines together.
Okay.
And it was no different than we could do in our place. There were literally a bench, lin bins in front of the guy, parts knocking about, and he was literally picking them up and putting them together. I couldn't believe how...
You thought it was primitive, considering it was this professional company that's revered worldwide that...
Well, it was it. Nothing wrong with the quality. It just is too expensive,
yeah.
you know, in
yeah.
the modern world.
Yeah.
And it didn't surprise me at all that in the early 90s they were about to go bust.
Yeah.
And, you know, the City of London said they would go bust. There was nothing that could save them. It wasn't a question of it could be saved. It was over.
Yeah.
They'd left it too long. Not me. And so I understand the family came up with the funds to try and save Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to come up with an engine that would cost a lot less to make, but be just as good. And I expected it to be just as good.
Yeah.
And we were a bit surprised when a few people with Boxsters turned up and said, something's gone wrong with my engine. And Porsche say, I've got to put a new engine in, but it's about as expensive as the cars
are. Yeah, definitely.
So we tried to help them, but we got in touch with our local Porsche main agent. Can we have all the bits to put an engine back together again, please? Gasket, set, seals. No, sorry. Sorry? Why? Why can't we? Are you not going to sell them to us? No, it's not that. They haven't been released yet. We haven't got everything to put the engines together.
Wow, okay.
Well, what are they supposed to do, these people? Well, buy a new engine.
Yeah.
The only solution we could think of was to find some crashed cars and where the front has been crashed.
Yeah.
So the engine's probably okay, low mileage, and literally just take the engine out and put it in, replace it. And that worked well for our customers. It saved them money and it gave them a good engine and got them on the road again. But it meant we gradually got a pile of engines in front of us. And then one day Porsche said, we're just letting you know, we've got all the parts now to rebuild an engine.
Sure, yeah.
So we took the first one apart. There was no need to take them apart before then. And, well, people say they're a rubbish. Some people say they're a rubbish engine. They actually aren't. They're extremely clever.
Which engine code is this? M96?
Yeah, the early Boxsters. What's the code?
M96, yeah.
And very, very clever design. And I could see straight away that it would cost much less to manufacture.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a cheap thing. I mean, the inside where the crankshaft bearings go, they bothered to put heavy metal inserts in. You just don't find that in engines. You know, that was a sign to me that they weren't trying to make a cheap engine at all.
Yeah.
They were just trying to production engineer it to provide a modestly priced car.
Yeah.
Where they could survive and make some money again.
Yeah. And you can't blame them for a company to do that.
Absolutely perfect. But I did say, I don't like two features of it.
Go on.
And one was that the cylinders were just a tube at the top, which would flex.
Right.
And I was worried that they might crack. And I didn't like the intermediate shaft bearing being enclosed with a seal. And Tobias has got some of those bits here. If anyone's
We're just going to hand some stuff around, so if you want to take a look
If you want to have a look at some of this stuff, please feel free. And he can explain it if anyone's interested. And so, the problem is that if you have a bearing that's relatively small for the load it's going to take, with seals both side and grease inside, when you run it in, little bits of metal get worn off the inside of the track. And what they do is mix with the grease. And if you've ever seen grinding paste for grinding in a valve,
it's the same stuff, right?
It's the same stuff.
Yeah.
And so what we realized was the bearing was low enough in the engine for the oil in the engine, splash oil, to lubricate it anyway.
Right.
So if you replaced it and took the seal off, that seemed like a better solution.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we still thought it was a bit on the small side.
Right.
For the loading.
Yeah.
So we did that, and as you know, very soon afterwards, all sorts of companies came up with IMS solutions.
It's funny that, isn't it?
Yeah, and we didn't want to get involved in that. Do you know what the reason is? When the example that's going round, the old ones with the small bearing had a very thin piece of metal that the bearing was pushed into. It wasn't substantial.
Yeah.
When you took the bearing out, it wasn't round anymore. The hole that had been precision ground before was a little bit distorted, and sometimes it had micro weld spots on it where the loading had transferred. You're aware of that. So people just banging a new bearing in their shed wasn't going to be the answer. So we decided we didn't want to get involved in that because we don't want to get involved in anything that doesn't work perfectly or has a bad reputation.
And again, it goes back to your, all the way back to your roots, right?
Absolutely
you
right.
To make sure that it's good for as long as you're standing behind that personally, right?
Absolutely right. And so we did come up with a few improvements, a better spindle that somebody had machined right into the spindle with a sharp cornered recess and put a little O-ring in it, which meant it was very, very weak from fatigue, and some of them snapped. So we did what we could. And then we rang up to see if we could buy some bearings. This was the double row bearing then.
Yeah, yeah.
And the manufacturer said, no, we've stopped making them now. Porsche don't use them anymore. And they were only made for them. So, well, what are we supposed to do? Well, we have got some on the shelf. Can I have them? No, he said, they're out of their use-by date. Now, a bearing, they said, had a 2-year shelf life.
Of course it does. Yeah.
And
how long is it in your car for once you buy a car?
Well, that the reason is that it could go into a car that doesn't get sold for 2 years.
Yeah, okay.
And that's why they put the seal in on the bearing to keep the moisture out between building it and selling it. Not because, in my opinion, not because they thought that was the best engineering solution.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Completely, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, I said, well, how many have you got? I think he had about 35 left on the shelf. I said, well, I really need them. So this guy said, I'll tell you what, I'll ping the seals off and inspect them. And if they're all right, you can have them. And so we ended up with a stock which kept our customers going. Don't forget, we didn't want to sell them. We didn't want to get involved in people messing it up by fitting it themselves.
For sure, yeah.
And it wasn't only that. Knocking them in pushes the cam chain backwards, and the cam chain runs on a plastic runner and makes itself a nice little groove.
Yeah, that does, yeah.
Banging it backwards to get a bearing in or messing about with it could crack little bits of plastic off, you know. The whole thing was a tragedy, really. And eventually we decided it needed a much bigger bearing.
Right.
But of course, there wasn't enough metal in the end of the IMS shaft to open it out and put a bigger bearing in. But by pure luck, who knows how to make gears?
Funny that.
And sprockets and machine them and all the rest of it? Me. So we designed a new end gear. Where's Tobias gone?
Where's Tobias gone? Oh, there he is.
Have you got the shaft? Who's got the shaft? See that gear on the end? This gear here, there are two types. One of them has like a sprocket like that on it and a roller chain like you see on a bicycle or a motorbike.
Yeah.
And later on, they changed it for that, which is called a Hi-Vo chain, which is like a gear.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is quite expensive for us to make all this, but there's nothing wrong with that. So what we did was chop this off, make a new end with a much bigger diameter shoulder on it to take a bigger bearing and fitted them in. But of course, we could only do it if the engine was apart.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
We never offered to sell them because again, that meant that our shaft would be going in an engine somebody might put together incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it would be our fault.
Yeah.
We didn't want that. We'd prefer to not have
and
the
again,
business.
I'll go back to the same thing again. There's something, no question, I would have, just because of your name, the brand Hartec, I would have brought an engine to you. But listening to you talk about it, just the simple choice between not to manufacture products and sell them to anybody, the fact that you care so much about longevity that actually that's meaningful to you, so you're not going to do that. That's another reason why I come to you guys, because it's that philosophy around keeping it right. You know,
don't forget, I'd had my turn at being the big I am and didn't like it.
Yeah,
I'd accepted just having a little business that I feel happy running.
Yeah,
and so expanding it wasn't really a big issue. Not bothered about that.
No, of course not.
Just
no.
Wanted to make a good job
of it.
The
best stuff, yeah, definitely.
The next thing that was quite interesting was that the cylinders started cracking.
Yeah, now this is the bit where it's all kind of, it starts, the stories start flooding around the internet and people start panicking before they bought a car and, yeah.
And the reason is because where the piston goes up and down is just like a tube. And how thick the tube is influences how stiff it is and how much it will flex.
Yeah, okay.
As they went from the 2.5 litre Boxster through bigger and bigger and bigger engines, mm-hmm. they didn't change anything about the design of the engine. So in other words, the size of the engine, the width of it, all that remained the same.
It's the same basic casting, it's just...
Everything.
Wow.
So consequently, they were gradually getting less space inside where the coolant goes round as they made the pistons bigger and bigger and bigger. And in the end, when they went from the 3.2 Boxster to the 3.4996, they probably didn't feel they had the room or decided not to make the outside of the tube any bigger.
Right.
So they bored it out instead.
Yeah.
So that made it thinner. So now you've got a bigger piston pushing harder on the tube that is now thinner than it was before. So those are the ones that started cracking after a period of time. The earlier ones with the smaller pistons tend not to.
Yeah.
So that was really the only problem, and we had to make replacement cylinders. And two-stroke cylinders that I'd made years before.
All those years before, yeah.
Were aluminium with Nicosil plating.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't a big challenge to me. And so that's how I decided to do it. And it meant we had to have quite large material. And thank you very much, Porsche, because what you did, where's Tobias?
Where's Tobias?
Can you pick that casting up, mate?
Yeah. Quick, Tobias, pick the casting up.
And just show them that the top is a circle. This part here on the outside is a circle doing nothing. So what it meant was, when I looked to machine this thin, flexible piece out, there was a place where I could also machine a circle and make the top of my replacement liner fit in there. So instead of it being flexible and instead of it being pushed sideways by the piston, just happen to have an example of, I could make it the same as what they call a closed deck. So
this is closed deck, basically, isn't it?
That's an example of one of the cylinders.
I mean, that's a bloody lovely bit. I mean, while I was
about it, I thought I'll increase the cooling capacity because if you notice, that's very short.
Yeah, it is.
The space for coolant to cool the cylinder is very low. Before that, on a 944, it was about that deep. And since that, on the Gen 2s, 991s and so on, it is again about that deep. So this particular run of engines from, 98 to 2008 had limited coolant capacity.
Sure.
So we increased the surface area to help. Have you got the one in half?
Thank you so much for bringing this stuff around, because it's one thing to talk about it, but actually getting hands-on and seeing this is a game changer. So.
Well, I'm hoping this will help, because if I show you this half a cylinder, when that's in the casting, the only part of the casting that stops it tilting is the bit I'm holding with my thumb and forefinger. So in other words, everything below it and everything above it, if that was a Porsche liner, the thrust loads would be trying to squash it and tilt it.
Yeah.
Whereas by doing it the way we do it, we rigidify the whole thing, and that keeps the cylinder bore more round. That improves the compression. That makes it last longer.
Yeah.
The whole thing's a much better job, but unfortunately, it's not the cheapest in the world. But as I was very pleased to chat to this gentleman over there, whose engine we rebuilt when...
Oh, you got a customer. Brilliant.
Some years ago.
But it's still going.
Many of our engines have exceeded the mileage they did before they went wrong the first time. And we've now made just over 18,000 liners, which have been fitted.
And 18,000
liners.
Wow.
And we've only had three or four back with problems, and none of them were to do with the liner. One of them was a German soldier traveling to Germany in his Boxster, who had a radiator or a hose go, something like that, on the Autobahn, and decided to do the 10 miles to the service station,
anyway.
For example.
Yeah.
Some people sneakily turn them into turbos, low-pressure turbos, without telling us, which means that they have very high compression pressures and detonation, which melts the piston, little things like that. And we recently had one from, was it Bulgaria, Tobias? Where's is he hiding again? He does that at work.
That's why he's done so well. He's never there.
But who didn't tell us, he just wanted the cases doing, and we sold them to him.
Yeah.
And this is where it fell foul, because he missed out one of the circlips. It didn't fit properly.
Okay. Yeah.
And the gudgeon pin came out sideways
and
wrecked one of the cylinders.
Yeah. But it goes back to that same point, though, doesn't it? About
it's the
when
worry.
You've got control over your own QC,
it's a real
you guarantee
worry.
It. Yeah.
So we almost got to the end of the story now. I mean, I was very lucky that I knew how to do this stuff.
Yeah.
Very lucky that I knew how to do small batch production. So that was great.
Mm-hmm.
But then one thing we've always done is made our engines have more torque because, well, this is an age-old argument that you could have with loads of people, but I'm afraid it's torque that makes the car accelerate, not power.
Yeah.
You just said yes if you don't believe me.
Oh, no, I do believe you. Yeah.
If you could picture taking the engine out and putting a torque spanner with a socket on the shaft that drives the gearbox, and you're sat there.
Yeah, carry on.
You start turning that handle in gear and the car starts moving, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
The harder you push it, the more torque you're putting into the transmission, the faster it will go.
Yeah.
Power is only how hard you push it times how fast, how many times you rotate it in a minute.
Yeah.
For some reason, because power increases with revs, it's become the thing that everybody looks at. How much power have you got? Doesn't interest me.
No, it doesn't interest me. It's basically meaningless.
And because I used to have to design gearboxes for very temperamental two-strokes with very narrow power bands, I understood that if you increase the revs, when you change gear, you also increase the rev drop, which means that you need a wider power band.
Yeah.
Now, anybody that knows anything about engines knows that if you do something to make them rev higher, it makes them have narrower power bands. So you actually shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
And when we started racing, we knew nothing whatsoever about racing Porsches or cars. And I thought it would be a great idea for the workforce if we had a go at racing.
Why not?
So they all said, "We're going to buy somebody's race car." Nope, we're going to buy it, get an old Boxster and do it ourselves. And I think our fellow competitors were all rubbing their hands who'd been racing.
I don't think they were. I reckon they were probably, oh God, Artek's going to join in there. What are we going to do?
I don't think so. I think they thought this will show them up, the clever
what's it. Oh, we'll wait and see, right?
And we thought about it, worked on it, worked hard. And what I did was see what the, I don't know if anyone's aware what a rear wheel torque graph is like, but when you change up through the gearbox, you get less torque through your wheels. It's like a multiplication effect. So when you go really fast in first gear, if you went straight into top gear from first gear, it would go really slowly, wouldn't it?
It would.
Well, the engine's producing the same torque. And that's because as you go through the gearbox, the amount of torque at the back wheel reduces.
Sure.
So we're in a Boxster that we're going to race that's never going to do more than 130 miles an hour on any circuit, but is geared for far more than that. So the last thing you want to do is make it rev any higher.
Yeah, yeah.
The regulation said you can adjust the rev limiter, the Porsche Club regulations.
Yeah.
So all of our competitors had adjusted it so that it would rev higher. But by doing the graph, we could see that actually it was better to change gear earlier than the old peak revs. So we told our drivers, change gear in third at this revs, in fourth at that revs.
Yeah.
And our cars started to win the races. In fact, we won on the very first race we took the car to Brands Hatch.
Of course you did.
Yeah. It was the second race. The first race wasn't so good. The second race, the guy was 14th. And apparently, as he was going round, he suddenly thought to himself, I can win this. And so he gradually overtook the whole field on the last lap, in fact, on the last corner, and overtook the second, the guy who was in the lead, and won the race. And
this is almost movie-like at this point.
It is a bit, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah.
Not movie, I forgot Silver Dream Racer. Yeah, I made the Silver Dream Racer for the David Essex film as well. So if anybody ever watches it, you'll find my name on the credits. But anyway, that we'll forget that. And so what happened was the organisers of the event were annoyed because they need to have lots of people paying to race to keep the series open.
Yeah.
And this new Boxster had come along and was beating everybody. So they put extra weight on it, which annoyed me because it's supposed to be a calculation balance between the power and the weight. But despite that, I think carrying about an extra 38 kilos compared to everybody else's power to weight on 996s and 993s and 964s, we were still winning. So it then went round the paddock that Barry Hart used to make racing motorbike engines. I bet he's gone in that engine and made it illegally fast inside. And I didn't like that because it would give me no
satisfaction. You're a man of integrity.
No satisfaction whatsoever that would give me. So this was at Silverstone halfway through the season. And I didn't know what to do, but I asked the organisers, would they get one of the scrutineers, please, to seal the engine? They had special paint. It was like multicoloured paint.
Okay.
And they would paint it across all the engine joints. So if anybody took it apart, you could tell.
You'd be able to know, yeah.
And will you come at the end of the season and we'll strip it?
A proof point.
So that's what happened. Two scrutineers turned up at the end of the season when we won the championship. We took the engine out and stripped it. To my shock, they had with them a dossier from Porsche in Germany of everything you could ever think of to measure. Micrometers, all sorts. Couldn't find a single thing wrong with it. Because, of course, that wasn't the reason we hadn't cheated at all, and neither would we.
Good for you.
So, with this knowledge of torque, it occurred to me one day, it's costing people a lot of money, doesn't it, to have your engine seatbelt.
He sat there, he's recovering still.
He seemed happy enough. But wouldn't it be nice to give them something back better, so that when they get their engine back, it's not just going to be more reliable and last longer, but actually perform better.
Yeah, yeah.
So with that knowledge of torque, I knew that if we increased the capacity, not too much, but by a certain amount, it would make them have more torque lower down, and they would be just as fast at the top end, because although they might struggle to get enough air in, you've got a bigger capacity that it's working through.
Right, yeah, sure.
So I decided to make capacity conversions, and we did so, and they were far better than we imagined, much better, and produced twice the torque of the capacity increase in percentage terms in the mid-range. And people loved them, so we started to make them. And then they rang up one day, one or two customers who keep little notebooks and keep a record of the miles they do and the fuel they use. And they said, love the car, nothing wrong with it, but just wondering if there's something wrong with it actually, because I'm getting a lot more miles to the gallon than I used to, and I think I'm driving it faster. So, to be honest, I'll be dead straight with you. This puzzled me. I've never been the slightest bit interested in economy. It's just performance. Performance, reliability.
Yeah, you know,
if you have to use more fuel to do it,
like a true engineer.
That's the price you pay. But that puzzled me. Until a penny started to drop, that development, and this is why I hope I didn't bore you too much with the bit about motorbikes, but that is where chickens came home to roost, because what it meant was that development I was doing on higher compression engines that led to me selling my business and working for Armstrong was actually what was behind why they were more economical. And so I already, if you like, had a head start on the
Absolutely.
Thought process about
yeah.
it. And so we started to look into why. And what we realized is quite astonishing. We realized that almost everybody who's interested in engines has been misled by wrong descriptions, wrong terminology, and because of it had missed a very simple way to make these cars' engines more reliable, better, more responsive, have more power, and be considerably more economical, which is incredible.
It's almost impossible to achieve. It's one of those things that's just a unicorn, right?
And I have brought some. Just hold. I'm not trying to sell that book, by the way.
Here we go.
No, I'm not trying to sell it, because I've only got a few copies left, and I'm not having another print.
The Pursuit of Dreams, Barry Hart.
But it is on the internet. If anybody, not very expensive. If anybody wants to read about the motorbike thing, but in there is some graphs that I've got. If you want to get that out, Tobias. And they show you some interesting things. For example, no, I don't need them. You can try and work it out. For about 50 or 60 years, if you asked an old, like myself, guy who knows about engines, what speed are they most economical at, you will find that most people that know anything about engines will say, yeah, about 50, 55 miles
yeah,
an hour.
Yeah.
Right, let's just think about that. Why would a car be more economical at that speed than at 25 miles an hour, when the air resistance is less, the mechanical resistance is less?
Mm.
So we started to look into that and found that our own cars, we measured things, did loads of testing, were no different. They use lots of fuel at slow speed. It gradually gets better, up to about 50 or 60 miles an hour, by which time the wind resistance does start to hammer it, and so it gets worse again. But we decided if we could build a higher compression engine, that would solve the problem and make them more economical at the slower speeds. Now, this thing is patented both in England and America, and it's too complicated to get into in big detail here today, but just basically the amount of energy you get out of fuel increases if you squeeze it to a higher pressure. It's the fundamental principle of the Otto cycle engine, has been for
right.
over 140 years. So when you're going slowly, you haven't got enough air in the engine to compress it to a high pressure, because you only need a small amount of power.
Mm.
So basically, when you're driving at 30, 40, 50, 60 in traffic, you're burning fuel unnecessarily.
Sure.
Inefficiently.
Yeah.
So if you can raise the compression ratio, it needs less fuel to do the same speed. And that means less fuel, more money in your pocket, less emissions, global warming contributed towards helping, all a good thing.
Yeah.
Just one downside. When you're flat out, it'll blow up because of detonation. So we reversed the logic. And what we said was, well, forget the detonation thing to start with, because the benefit elsewhere is fantastic. So let's build one and see how we can stop the detonation.
Amazing.
So that's what we did.
And how long did it last?
We've got three cars now driving around. Three cars which have never detonated, have never seized, have more power than they did standard, will reach a higher top speed, have so much low down engine response. You can drive a 997 at about 900 revs per minute at about 26 miles an hour in top gear and just touch the throttle and drive away and without changing down. In fact, it's quite weird because, you know, I've driven 996s and 7s now for 30 or 40 years, as long as they've been around.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And most of the gearing's the same, so I'm very used to what gear I'm in. We did some work on an engine and I took it out for a test run and I started cursing the guys because they're very good and usually, they don't usually get things wrong, but I couldn't get it across the gate from fourth across to fifth.
Yeah.
It was somehow stuck against the gate until I realised I wasn't in fourth, I was in sixth. And this is really odd. You'd think you'd know whether you were in, what gear you were in.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, people drive cars with the feel.
Mm.
And we've had other people, like yourself, would be invited. You could come along to our place, jump in one of these.
Oh, I'm definitely taking you up on that.
One of these three eco cars, and you would go out and you probably think, you know, hang on, what gear am I in?
Yeah.
And I've said to some engineering experts in a 997, when we're doing 28 miles an hour in Bolton and say, stick it into sixth.
Yeah.
And they look at you astonished. Oh, what do you mean? Just put it in sixth. And they just drive along and say, I can't believe this. This is just staggering. And one of the most interesting things is we made a complete mess of our statistics. What we did, I don't know what you would do. If you were trying to check the economy of this idea of mine to do with high compression engines, well, this is what we did. We had two people that lived some distance away, so they each had a high compression car to go to and from work. Said, right, tomorrow I want you to be in fourth gear as much as possible,
yeah,
at 40 miles an hour, then at 50 miles an hour, then at 60 miles an hour. And we fitted a little device that you can buy. They're very cheap, actually, about 45 quid. Plug it into a port, which happens to be there, in your car, if you've got a 997, the OBD2 port,
yeah.
And it records all sorts of things, everything. How much throttle you're using, how much fuel you're using,
yeah.
Volumetric efficiency, goes on and on. It downloads tons of stuff. And we did all that at the same speed, then at 40 miles an hour, then at 50 miles an hour. Very, very interesting. The only thing is, what we did get better economy, but it wasn't as much as our customers said. That's weird, isn't it? So the customers are saying, I'm getting about, you know, 20% more to the gallon or 25% more to the gallon. We were getting about 12. Well, that's very strange. Until the penny dropped, that they're driving them in a higher gear.
Right, okay.
So by...
You rerun the tests?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I'll come down and do then.
We're just getting around to it now. But it messed up a lot of records.
Interesting.
And it was only because I couldn't get that gear across that we suddenly realised that you drive a car, you don't drive a car by memory and thinking, oh, what gear am I in? It's 30 mile an hour limit.
Yeah.
I should be in third, you know, whatever. You don't. You just naturally shove it in a gear that feels
appropriate
right,
for that moment.
And
yeah,
keep
yeah.
up with the traffic and so on.
Yeah, sure.
And so, you know, we drive cars... Basically, we drive cars that we're forced to drive uneconomically most of the time.
Yeah, sure.
Just so that occasionally we can have a blast in them.
Yeah.
So we've come up with this idea. We've tried to get government backing. Unfortunately, they sent the idea to old engineers who said it wouldn't work, even though we're driving cars around proving that it does work. So we got rejected. It's costing us an absolute fortune, this development. But I feel obligated, if you like, to society, because we're talking about, you know, people are spending a fortune to save 2 and 3% economy.
Mm.
we're talking 15 to 20%, just
that's
like that.
That's really significant.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And it can be fit, all the cows that are in the world can be rebuilt. The engines could be rebuilt with higher compression pistons.
Yeah.
Using this theory of ours and not knock.
Yeah.
So we're committed to continuing to develop it. We've taken it a stage further now. We have a car now with a selector switch on it, and you can select eco, normal, or sport. Now that came about because my wife's got an electric car, and that's got a plus switch on it that goes.
I think it's, people just know they understand what each one of those means, right? So
eco means you're not going to run the battery down too quickly.
Yeah.
Normal means it's what you might expect for normal use, and sport is very, very fast, but it will run the battery down
absolutely,
quite quickly.
Yeah.
So I thought that's a brilliant idea. That's great because when I'm going shopping, I don't need sport mode. I just want to, you know, totter about. But when I'm out on the open road, I might want to flick it.
Yeah.
So we've done that, and we've managed to do it to our eco cars now. Now, that is a fantastic development.
Yeah.
And you can change it while you're driving along. You can just literally flick the switch. So you can choose now. Most of the time, you can't drive fast on public roads. Now and again, come on, we've all done it. Now and again, you can have a little blast. Lovely to be able to flick a switch and feel some really good performance. One of the interesting things is, I'm going to just go back to motorbikes for a bit. I once made a motorbike with a very flat torque curve. And when the first riders tested it, they said it wasn't very fast. So I had a stopwatch and said, yeah, but you've just nearly done a second faster than your fastest ever lap round Donington Park. And they looked at me in astonishment. I couldn't believe it. And that's because of a sensation of acceleration. If you feel, if you have a flat torque curve, once you get it going, you don't really get a terrific sensation of speed. If you have a thing that an engine which is very top-endy, you do. You put it in a gear, you put your foot down, as the noise goes up and the revs go up, it pulls more, feels like a racing car, everyone's happy.
Yeah.
We've managed to reproduce that now, even though our eco engines have a really big, broad torque curve, you can flick sport and it'll go up.
Wow, nice.
So it's all a very interesting development, which is really should be funded much higher than we can manage, but we're doing our best and we'll just plod on with it. And we hope that one day when people come for a rebuild, we'll be able to offer them standard rebuild, nothing wrong with it, great product. If they want to go for an eco engine, it may be that they'll almost be forced to because in America in particular, they're bringing
California
in,
particularly, yeah.
Yeah, they're bringing in limits to improve economy if you want to drive on their roads. Over here we have the ULEZ zones and so on, and I dare say road tax, they'll probably increase it on cars like this. So it may well be that we can help preserve them for longer and keep them going for longer, save people money, give them a better drive.
Yeah,
they're fantastic drive, these eco cars. They're
I'll stick a video out.
When are you coming up?
As soon as we can book it in. We'll sort something out afterwards.
Okay.
So what I want to take away from this is I've gone from being terrified of the idea of buying a 996 or buying a 997, and I don't think that's ever going to go away. I think I'm always going to feel slightly nervous around it, but that level of confidence I would have around, okay, even if I had an absolute disaster on my hands, there's no question of where I would go, and I think that's as a result of...
Thank you.
That's a result of you, Barry, really, from... the early days, all the way through, your integrity, the changes you made, the moves you made, all the way through to recruit Bias and bringing him through, all of those things.
It's now up
to the sum of that.
Yeah. But it is now up to the team because, you know, I'm 78 in a couple of weeks, a few weeks' time, and I can't keep going on forever.
No.
But I've created a fantastic team of guys, and what they can do jointly is better than I could ever do on my own. And that's because they've been very carefully selected. They've been helped to develop. We have lost one or two who, when they had the freedom to develop themselves, didn't want to be restricted then.
And that's their right too, right? To go off and do their own thing.
I'd be a hypocrite, wouldn't I, to complain.
Yeah.
So although I invested a lot of time and money in those guys, I never had a bad attitude towards them going and setting up on their own. And so there are a number of Porsche specialists around Bolton now who started with our business and are now doing their own work. In a way, I'm sad that I couldn't have kept them, but, you know, as I say, I can't be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But the remaining team are absolutely brilliant, honestly. They're wonderful guys, and they will carry on the Hartrek tradition long after I can't do it anymore.
Well, look, thank you so much, Barry. I've really enjoyed your time. I hope you've really enjoyed speaking to Barry as well. So please give Barry a round of applause. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Barry.
Thanks so much for your time. We really enjoyed today. This episode will be on Spotify, all your podcast streaming services, and on YouTube as well. If you haven't liked to subscribe, you can do that. It's Rengineering, and I'll see you next time. Take care for now. Bye-bye. Well, I really hope you enjoyed that episode. I definitely did. I loved shooting. That was the first time I'd ever shot an episode in front of a live audience, which was very fun. Please do subscribe if you haven't already. The podcast is doing very well. It's been top 20 in the UK automotive podcast chart. Very proud of that. So I'm going to want to try and keep expanding from there on in. So if you haven't already, head over to Spotify or any podcast streaming service to listen to this every week on a Thursday. That's when the episodes drop. Otherwise, plenty more content coming out on the YouTube channel. My build, my 981 that's right next to me here, that's happening. The Ren 550, I nearly bought a car today that was going to be the donor for that, but there's lots coming up anyway. So I hope you're enjoying the episodes. Please do get in touch if you need to. info@rengineering.com or I'm on Instagram @rengineeringuk. Otherwise, take care, go out for a drive, and I'll speak to you soon. Take care, bye-bye.